Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
You move into an old house on the edge of town. Nothing fancy, but you like the old feel and the extra space. Except for the basement. It's just super creepy. But you like the house as a whole. And the area is just removed enough for you to find the peace and quiet you've been pining for. The place has a pensive stillness to it, like it's waiting for something, or someone. It starts with a dream. Every night, it's the same. A woman in a rose print dress stands at the foot of your bed. Her dress is tattered and torn, her arms bruised, her wrists bound. She doesn't speak. She points. Same direction, every time, toward the backyard. The recurring dream continues into your second week in your new home. But now, the woman beckons you to follow. And you do. She silently leads you to the back door and down the steps, across the yard. She suddenly stops a few feet shy of the overgrown and untended garden. She stares intently at a specific spot as she raises her bony, sheet-white finger at it. And then she's gone in an instant. You stand there staring at nothing, the horror suddenly dawning on you that your feet are cold and wet against the grass. This was no dream. The next morning, you find the spot. It's not difficult. The garden may be overgrown, but this spot is particularly bare. You begin to dig. The deeper you get, the greater the pit in your stomach grows. The image of the woman, her eyes, her bound wrists, her dress. Thump. Your shovel hits something soft, but not quite as soft as the dirt that surrounds it. In the darkness of the hole, a swatch of dirty white fabric pokes through the earth. Your eyes focus on the red of the roses printed upon it. Weeks later, authorities finally confirm. Female, late 20s, estimated time of death, 50 years ago, which lines up perfectly with a local rumor that began at the time of a woman, a housewife, who'd suddenly gone missing in the 70s. Her husband had claimed she'd left town with another man, but familiar with the all-too-fresh bruises and all-too-quick excuses, the townspeople had always suspected a darker turn of events. After the discovery, the dreams stop. The house seems to get just a little bit warmer, like a weight has been lifted, like something that has been stuck there for years has finally been set free. You helped right a wrong. You helped someone voiceless tell their story. But you don't like to talk about what really happened, how the discovery of the body really went down. Who would believe something so insane anyway as a ghost showing you exactly where to look? Welcome back to the Paranorm Girl podcast. I am your host, Kristen. I hope you liked my modern twist on Pliny the Younger's ghost story. It is a ghost story as old as, well, as old as the earliest ones ever told. You can switch out the characters, the genders, modes of communication, the location, the era, but at its core, this story is the same. And it's one about closure, justice, righting wrongs, bringing what was done in the dark into the light. The endings can be bittersweet. The ghosts in these tales, they don't always get the eye for an eye owed to them. But sometimes they do. Sometimes the ghosts of those whose lives were taken too soon and so unfairly play such a significant role in righting the wrongs done to them. And while this opening story may have been birthed of the dark, dank recesses of my own mind, it's based on fact, on an inconvenient truth. Ghosts have helped the living solve mysteries surrounding their death and even their own murders more often than you would think. Eleanor Sidgwick concluded this, following a survey that she gave in 1885 in reference to apparitions who appear to the living. There is a total absence of any apparent object or intelligent action on the part of the ghost. If its visits have any object, it entirely fails to explain it. Today we are discussing important examples of ghosts who did appear, did communicate, and definitely had a significant object to their visitations. Some of these stories are more anecdotal than others. Some are a little harder to explain away than that. The main points I am concerned with on this one is to first showcase just how many different ways ghosts have communicated to the living in situations where, if they had not, their murderers may have never been caught, their bodies may have never been found, and the mystery around their disappearance may have gone unanswered forever. I am also concerned with making a solid case that this kind of activity does indeed happen. And it's weird, and it's unexplainable by any other means. As to Eleanor Sidgwick's conclusion, I'm inclined to disagree with her for all of the following reasons. One of the most well-known cases of a ghost who helped solve their own murder via communication with the living took place in 1897. As Troutshoe headed to work at the blacksmith shop, he called on his neighbors, asking that they send their 12-year-old son, Andy Jones, to his home that morning to collect some eggs to take up to the store and to ask his wife, Zona, if she needed anything. Trout and Zona had met when he moved to Greenbrier County only the year before, entered a brief courtship, were quickly married, and were now 3 months into their happily ever after. Over the course of the morning, Trout would end up asking that Andy stop by his home several times before the boy finally did so. Upon arriving, the house sat dark and quiet. So, Andy called out for Mrs. Shue, and receiving no reply, entered the home to look for her. It didn't take long before he discovered her body lying at the foot of the staircase. She laid stretched out with her feet together and her hand laid across her stomach. Her head was turned slightly to one side and her eyes stared wide and lifeless as Andy fled to find his mother. When the news reached the blacksmith shop, Trout tore home to see for himself. The local physician, Dr. Knapp, was called. Trout was devastated, inconsolable at the loss of his wife. And in the hour it took for the doctor to arrive, he had carried Zona upstairs, dressed her in her final outfit, a high-collared dress, and a large veil tied in a bow beneath her chin, and placed her in their bed. Dr. Knapp examined Zona as her loving husband cradled her head and obviously grieved. Due to the circumstances, the doctor's exam was cursory, and initially he would state the cause of death to be everlasting faint, which would be followed by childbirth, though it is unknown if Zona had even been pregnant at the time. During her wake the following day, Trout stayed by Zona's side, clearly grieving and affected by her death, as anyone with eyes could see. Some might say his behavior was above and beyond natural. Some might even say it bordered on theatrical. Keeping vigil by his wife's side, ever the loving partner, even in death, Trout would place a folded-up sheet on one side of her head and a rolled-up piece of cloth on the other, explaining it would help her to rest easier. He then tied a large scarf around her neck, explaining, eyes brewing with tears, that it had been her favorite. Methinks the lad protests too much. Murmuring began to spread amongst the funeral party. But alas, what you gonna do? You know, what are you gonna do? Zona was buried the following day. Now, one person at this wake had a particular dislike of Trout. She'd never liked him, never trusted him since the very moment her daughter introduced them. Mary Jane Heaster, Zona's mother, was convinced that this no-good drifter grifter had something to do with her daughter's death. Though she knew there was no proof, her suspicions would be further aroused by a strange incident, a sign of sorts. Following the wake, she called attention to the folded-up sheet used to prop Zona's head during viewing. Trout would tell her, "You can keep it, Mother." She took it home with her. Though it appeared white and clean, it smelled quite strange, quite awful. And so she washed it. Pressing it down into the wash tub, the water turned red. So she ended up washing it again, boiling it, drying it over and over, freezing it. But no matter what she tried, the sheet retained a reddish tinge. Out! Out! Damned spot! Macbeth. So, taking this as a sign from her daughter that perhaps her suspicions weren't far off the mark in regards to her son-in-law, Mary, an already pious woman, took to praying harder, deeper, longer. Her prayers were constant, and in them she begged for Zona to appear, to be allowed to come back and tell her the truth. I prayed to the Lord that she might come back and tell me what had happened, and I prayed that she might come herself and tell on him. And after weeks of fervent prayers, suddenly, one night, they were answered. A vision of Zona began to appear at her bedside. After about an hour spent in prayer, I turned over, and there stood my daughter. And I put my hand out to feel for the coffin, but it was not there. Over the course of 4 nights, Zona would communicate with her mother. She seemed to hesitate to speak to me and departed. The next night, after I had prayed again that the manner of her death might be shown, she again appeared and talked more freely and gave to me to understand that I should be acquainted with the whole matter. The second night, she told me that her neck was squeezed off at the first joint, and it was just as she told me. The third night, she again appeared and disclosed more to me, and on the fourth night, she appeared and told me all about the difficulty, how it occurred, and how her death was brought about. And here is what Zona said. He came that night from the shop and seemed angry. I told him supper was ready, and he began to chide because I had prepared no meat for supper. And I replied that there was plenty. There was bread and butter, applesauce, preserves, and other things that make a very good supper. And he flew mad and got up and came toward me when I raised up, and he seized each side of my head with his hands and by a sudden wrench. dislocated my neck. Zona would go on to describe details about her home and the surrounding area, somewhere Mary had never been, but was then able to describe perfectly to others later. Following these visits, Mary would go to the local prosecutor, John Alfred Preston, to convince him that her daughter's case needed to be reopened. And she shared the visitations and what was said with him. And despite this type of evidence, which would have really been difficult to introduce in court unless inquired about by the defense, which thankfully it mistakenly would be, Preston was open and sympathetic to Mary's plight. And surprisingly, he would reopen the case. An inquest was made and an exhumation to re-examine Zona's body planned. Upon the examination, something was discovered that had been severely overlooked initially. Her neck was hella broken, like all the way broken, just as described by Zona's ghost. Trout, present at the exhumation, once again acted unnaturally, manic, suspicious, and upon the discovery of Zona's neck, he was immediately placed under arrest. 5 months following Zona's death, Erasmus Stribling Trout Shoe would be sitting on trial for her murder. In court, sure as his defense was of the nail in the coffin to make Zona's mother appear less credible, they introduced the ghost thing. Try as they might to make her appear unsure, wishy-washy, not all there, they would fail. Mrs. Heaster, did you not have a dream that roused your suspicions and led you to have the body exhumed? Mary was steadfast and sure through her time on the stand. She would deny she was anything but wide awake. I had no dream, for I was as fully awake as I am in this moment. Mary's testimony, especially in regards to her communications with Zona, something felt by the defense to be the surefire way to the get-out-of-jail-free card for Trout, was in all actuality incredibly powerful and compelling. She was well known in town to be a pious, Christian, honest woman, and her testimony, as circumstantial as it was taken as gospel and would end up being the strongest card played for the prosecution. The trial lasted 8 days. The jury deliberated just over an hour, and Trout would be found guilty and sentenced to life at the West Virginia State Penitentiary. And if you feel his sentence was not commensurate for Zona's murder, you would not be alone. Shortly following the trial, a mob of angry citizens would attempt to kidnap him in order to lynch him, a la Tombstone's John Heath. This attempt was unsuccessful. And that is the bittersweet element of some of these stories. The ghost in question may have found closure of sorts, but don't always necessarily find equality in the ending of their stories. But then again, perhaps Zona ultimately did find equal justice. 3 years into his incarceration, Trout up and died. Reportedly, it was due to a tuberculosis outbreak amongst the prison population. Some retellings leave the illness a bit more mysterious and unexpected than that. Zona Heaster Shue's story is well known for very good reason. It is the only case on record in which testimony from a ghost led to a murder conviction. Often, the first to sense that something is wrong are the people that are closest to us. When someone goes missing, is hurt, is killed, it's the mothers, the fathers, the siblings who wake in the middle of the night with a start or are filled with a feeling they can't explain. Sometimes it's something undeniable and in their faces, as in the case of Mary Heaster, literally seeing her daughter standing before her Sometimes it's a knowing. Sometimes it is a dream. Another well-known case is that of the Red Barn Murder from 1827 in Polstead, Suffolk, England. 24-year-old Maria Martin was murdered by her lover, William Corder, inside a local landmark called the Red Barn. She was then put into a sack and buried in one of the grain storage bins. It would be a year before her body was discovered and William brought to trial and ultimately found guilty of the crime. William had done a good enough job of hiding the fact Maria was missing for that year with letters sent to her family explaining that they had eloped and were living as a married couple, as she had wanted, on the Isle of Wight. Though these letters always included excuses as to why she could not write herself, such as she had fallen too ill or had injured her writing hand. Oh, oops, some of the letters, they must have been lost in the post. Sorry, didn't get that. He found reasons to excuse why he could not bring his wife back to Polstead. His letters and excuses were already growing very, very suspicious. But then Maria's stepmother, Anne, began to have strange dreams. She dreamed that Maria was actually dead. She'd been killed in the Red Barn, her body buried, and William Corder had done it. After dreaming this multiple times, she finally convinced Maria's father, her husband, to go to the Red Barn and dig. He would acquiesce and quickly would discover the badly decomposing corpse of Maria Martin, with William Corder's green handkerchief tied around her neck. Now, it was concluded she was shot, not strangled, so I think the green cloth was just accoutrement, but that it was found on her body, pretty damning evidence. Now, I won't go into great detail about this case. There's so much more, but that's just because there's tons of information about it and the trial and the lead up to William's completion of his death sentence, because I want to spend extra time today on some lesser known cases, but I just want to include that a ghost finding equal justice may be rare, but in this case, that rarity was exceptionally exceeded, in my opinion. Not only was her murderer found guilty and hanged in front of a huge crowd for his crimes, but then his body was publicly dissected, left open for 5,000 people who filed in to stare at his filleted corpse. Death masks were created and sold. His skin was tanned and used to bind what has just been discovered this year to be not one, but two books about the murder, and his skeleton sat on display for teaching purposes at the West Suffolk Hospital before it was then put on public display at a museum in the Royal College of Surgeons of England for years. It wouldn't be until 2004 that William Corder was finally shown a bit of grace when his bones were finally taken down and he was cremated. Those skin books are still out there, though. So, wonder how his ghost is doing. Another quick example of communication from beyond the grave with a family member comes from the Philippines in 2004. The body of Catherine Ballesteros was discovered in her home. She had been stabbed 33 times. The scene was gruesome. It was so awful, her parents were not allowed inside and would be directed to see Catherine only following her transfer to the morgue. Upon seeing the corpse of her child, Catherine's mother, Emma, was overcome with grief, weeping and clinging desperately to her daughter, pressing her head against hers. In a moment between sobs, Emma heard something. A single whispered word from the lips of her dead child, a name, Baba. Blood, fingerprints, and footprints that were found on Catherine's floor were not a match for her. The police were hopeful but knew they'd only find the person responsible if he already had a record. Upon Immer sharing what she heard her daughter's voice say in the morgue, pieces quickly fell into place. Police discovered that Baba was a nickname of a well-known thief in Catherine's neighborhood, Ryan Baba Viscara. Ever the criminal, Baba was already serving time in jail for unrelated crimes, so the police easily tracked him down. The prints and blood found at the scene were a perfect match. Baba is currently serving a life sentence for Catherine's murder. Now, family doesn't always hear the call from the other side, and the deceased may be forced to connect with a stranger, but one who is especially equipped to handle this type of communication.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
I was sleeping and got awoken by this girl who said she had been murdered. She needed help. I was kind of stunned and not understanding what was going on and what I was supposed to do. Detroit, Michigan psychic medium Christy Robinette is quoted as saying on a show about the case. It was 2005. The urgency of the spirit led Robinette to begin searching the internet for a missing person who matched this girl that she was seeing. And when she stumbled across the file for Ashley Howley, she knew she'd found her. Ashley was only 20 years old, blonde, and very pretty. She'd gone missing from Columbus, Ohio, and hadn't been seen since June of 2004. Robinette says she received multiple visits from this girl. She wanted her body found. She wanted her family to have closure. She also wanted her ex-boyfriend to pay for what he had done. When the medium found her missing person's file and learned her identity, she jumped into action and contacted police. Now, police can be a little slippery when it comes to working with mediums, but they at least would put Christy in touch with Howley's family, which I think is very, very nice. Ashley led Christy to believe that she had been buried in a forested area near Columbus, and she tried to show her where her body could be found, presenting her with these images of light-colored pines. Now, Christy and a relative of Howley's set out for Columbus. They ended up in the right forest, but it didn't match what Ashley was showing Christy. Luckily, thanks to a chance run-in with a park ranger, they were directed to a specific spot that did include light-colored pines. Once there, Christy said she could feel it. This was the spot. But unfortunately, police were not going to dig on private property, especially if their cadaver dogs hadn't picked anything up, even if that private property was owned by the ex-boyfriend's father. Don't be suspicious. Don't be suspicious. Don't be suspicious. He was under suspicion. But the case would go cold for 2 years. It wasn't until 2007 that the ex-boyfriend in question was charged with murdering his own mother and her boyfriend in a trailer park. She was strangled. He was beaten to death with a shovel. Their bodies were discovered the day after Christmas. What a guy. What a fella. In exchange for no death penalty, he was convinced into giving up the location of Ashley's body. And wouldn't you know it, right in the spot, Christy, the psychic medium from Detroit, Michigan, pointed out, thanks to the help of a ghost. The reason the dogs hadn't picked up anything? Ashley had been encased in quick cement before being buried. Robert P. McMichael II is currently serving a life sentence in prison. Now, It doesn't always take communicating with a medium or close family for a ghost to get their message across. And it doesn't always require the ghost to speak. These next few cases take it back to basics and involve communication on a much simpler level, and they show us that profound communication can come to those of us who are in the right place at the right time and willing to pay attention to nothing more than a simple gesture. So, first, I am going to tell you a legend, and then I'm going to tell you about a strange coincidence with another tale that I found, one thought to be true. So this legend is from Australia, and it goes thus. In 1826, Englishman turned Australian farmer Fred Fisher suddenly vanished from Campbelltown. His neighbor, George Worrell, informed everyone that Fred had returned to England and in his absence had given George control of his property. A little while later, George then informed folks that, just kidding, he'd received word from Fred that actually he wasn't coming back to Australia and had conveniently bequeathed his farm to George, his trusty neighbor and good friend, George. Okay, all is well. 4 months later, a young local named John Farley was walking along a creek located near a field. Suddenly, he looks up to see Fred Fisher sitting on a nearby bridge. Without a word, Fred raised his hand, pointed to a spot in the field, and then disappeared in front of John's very eyes. While nobody took John's word for it, suspicions surrounding Fred's sudden departure had been raised. The sitch was kind of spooky, okay? So, the field was searched, and the remains of a murdered Fred Fisher were discovered in a shallow grave near the creek. This legend is the inspiration behind the annual 10-day-long festival of Fisher's Ghost, organized by the Campbelltown City Council. It's a legend that is well known in the area, though it is not necessarily thought to be true. I mean, maybe some think it's true. That's the tricky business of local legends that can't be traced to an originating event in history. They have no supporting documentation and wouldn't necessarily over time even match the originating event. But, there's that but. I think I might have found it, dudes. Maybe. It is a story that was documented in an 1875 book called Glimpses of the Supernatural, written by Frederick Lee. According to the writer, it had been published previously in another form in Australia and was generally accepted as true by the locals. The version he gives in the book was provided to him by people thoroughly competent to furnish a true and faithful account. He also states that the story would have taken place about 25 years prior, which would put it right around 1850. Remember, the Fred Fisher legend is said to have taken place not too much earlier than that in 1826. So here is the story. You tell me if anything about it sounds familiar. Two English-born cattle farmers immigrated to Australia, entered a partnership, and came to possess a considerable amount of property and financial success. One of the men suddenly goes missing. Weeks were spent searching for the missing man, but nothing could be found of him. One evening, his partner walked along the edge of a pond, heading home. He came upon a figure sitting beside the water. It was his missing partner. Without a word, the figure raised his hand and pointed his index finger at an especially dark depth of the pond before fading away. The next morning, the pool was dragged, and the body of his partner was discovered in the exact spot the apparition indicated. His body had been weighed down with a large stone, and the axe that had clearly been the implement of demise was recovered near his body. The axe was traced to its owner, a local adventurer, who, when searched, was found to be in possession of certain valuable documents belonging to the murdered man. And like George Worrell in the Fred Fisher legend, eventually confessed and was executed. I did forget to mention that part before. The distance between Campbelltown, Australia, and where this story is said to have taken place, Ballarat, is quite far, which does put a damper on my theory that they are conceivably the same story, one based off of the other. But then again, legends have a way of sharing themselves across time and space. So who knows? Perhaps one is an adaptation of the real story. Perhaps they're both adaptations of the unknown original event. I just thought it was interesting that one is said to be legend, while the other is said to be true, but both are so very similar. All right, so one more example here of a ghost helping a stranger and or non-medium living person to solve their murder. And then we're going to move on to some really weird, but arguably some of the most profound examples of this phenomenon. So this one took place in 2002 in Toronto. This one was rough for me. Lisa Poslins had been working late in her office. Lisa was especially involved and close-knit with her family. Both her mother and sister were very aware this night that her plan was to work through the evening. She had spoken with her mother on the phone earlier and was going to check in once she arrived safely at home. So when she didn't, alarm bells were immediately ringing. It was incredibly out of character for her. Her sister went to Lisa's office building and upon finding it locked, called police to come by and check on her. Police found no trace of Lisa in her office on the fifth floor. After searching the building, they found themselves stopped short at the locked door of a utility closet in the basement. A pool of blood could be seen seeping beneath the door. With the assistance of a security guard, they gained access and discovered an especially grisly scene. Blood on the floor, blood on the walls, a body of a petite woman lay on her side on the floor. She had been assaulted, stabbed multiple times, and her throat cut. It was quickly confirmed by her family following the discovery that this was their Lisa. The janitorial superintendent for the building, Rui Marquez, was immediately under suspicion because he had a special access to the entire building. He held the keys and security codes for all of the doors. He would be cleared by DNA evidence later, but his part in Lisa's story would not end there. 4 months later, with Lisa's case still open, her murderer still at large, Rui was cleaning in the same office building. He was shining a black-topped table when he noticed the reflection of someone in its surface standing behind him. Turning to look, he stared at a shadowy figure standing before him. The hair stood up on his arms. It was Lisa. Silently, Lisa's ghost raised her arm and pointed to the table over which Rui leaned, rag in hand and frozen. Before he could say or do anything, Lisa vanished. Looking down into the deep black abyss of the table, someone in particular came to mind. Lisa had just given him a clue. He would not volunteer this experience to anyone for fear of being seen as crazy. Not until police showed up, following up with him later, to question him about workers in his employ, would he share who it was he thought Lisa had been trying to show him. Nelson De Jesus did not consistently work in Lisa's building, but he did sometimes. He had previously encountered Lisa in Rui's presence, had taken a special notice of her. Rui recalled De Jesus referring to her as hot. Days following Lisa's murder, a group of cleaners arrived at the building for work, one of which was De Jesus, who volunteered the information that he couldn't have killed Lisa because he had been working at another location all weekend long. De Jesus, who had been convicted 11 years prior for sexual assault, was well aware of the location of the utility closet and knew how to access it without the keys due to a faulty lock at the time. De Jesus, who was known to always dress entirely in black. April of the following year, Nelson De Jesus would be found guilty of Lisa's assault and murder. Rui would be allowed to share his experience with Lisa's ghost in court, though unlike the Zona Heister shoe case, the final verdict was largely based on DNA evidence De Jesus left behind and his footprints matching those found near her body. Lisa's DNA was also found on a knife, a sheath, and handcuffs in his possession. He is serving a life sentence right now thanks to a little nudge from Lisa. It's cases like Lisa's that is the reason I do not do true crime. It doesn't take too much digging before you get past the flash and the drama of her case and you start seeing how her family described her, how much they loved her, what a vibrant, loving, kind, independent, artistic dreamer of a human being she was. It's just heartbreaking. As are the following cases. While the ghosts in our previous stories had relatively subtle parts to play, providing nothing more than a finger to point out the answers, these next two are examples of ghosts who were gonna be damned if they went unnoticed and their messages not received. On the night of February 21st, 1977 in Chicago, the fire department responded to calls about a fire on the 15th level at 2740 North Pine Grove. They arrived, entered the apartment, and quickly discovered the cause to be a smoldering mattress on the floor of the bedroom. Upon further investigation, they quickly discovered the body of Teresita Bassa beneath it. She was completely naked, with a kitchen knife protruding from the middle of her chest. Teresita's case was investigated for months following the discovery of her body. While there were plenty of leads and suspects the police followed up on, none quite fit the bill. Her murder came dangerously close to going cold. But in the strangest of strange turns of events, a fellow employee of Edgewater Hospital and fellow respiratory therapist Remy Chua began acting very odd at work. Now, despite these two women only ever having a nodding of heads as they passed each other in the hall's level of familiarity, Remy began to affect and imitate their late coworker. She seemed more talkative and cheery than usual, began to talk about subjects that Teresita was known to chat endlessly about, like the piano and classical music. Remy's voice and mannerism seemed to suddenly change, sounding and looking eerily similar to Teresita's own. She even began eating lunch in Teresita's favorite spot and humming to herself, as Teresita used to do. It was so odd and noticeable, staff began to complain it was making them uncomfortable. What they did not know is that Remy really could not help it, because Remy likely wasn't in control of her body. Prior to these changes taking place, Remy had been at work on a normal day. She had gone down to the locker room for a break. Sitting quietly in a chair, she suddenly felt a presence. When she looked up, the apparition of Teresita Bassa stood before her, silent, staring, unmoving. The only thing other coworkers would see at this moment was Remy sitting in a chair and suddenly bolting from the room in fright. And this event would then be followed by her changes in behavior. But Teresita had much more in store than this for Remy. A series of events would follow that would ultimately give Teresita the justice that she was after. The first took place while Remy and her husband, Dr. Chua, sat together in their living room one evening. Suddenly, and without explanation, Remy stood with a strange look on her face and exited the room. After some time had passed and she hadn't returned, Dr. Chua went to investigate and would find her lying across their bed, eyes wide open, staring dead ahead at the ceiling. Dr. Chua asked if she was feeling all right and what was the matter. In a voice not her own, Remy responded in the Tagalog language with a Spanish accent, Ako y Teresita Basa. I am Teresita Basa. After repeating this and continuing to ramble in Tagalog to her bewildered husband, she would then say, Dr. Chua, I would like to ask your help. She would say she wanted help to stop the person who had killed her. She begged him to call the police, that she would tell him what to say. This trance would last for 30 minutes before Remy suddenly came to, not understanding why she was in the bedroom or remembering any of the conversation she had just had. The next event took place not too long after. Again, the couple were sitting in their living room. Remy was on the phone with a real estate agent as the Chuas were in the midst of trying to sell their house. Abruptly, she stopped speaking. She turned, handing the phone receiver to her husband and muttered, Teresita wants to come back, before wandering away. He would once again find her lying across the bed, eyes open, staring straight ahead. Ako y Teresita Basa. Again in Tagalog. Again with a Spanish accent. Again, she begged for his help. Again, she begged him to call the police. The conversation went similarly to the first. However, this time, Teresita said, I will give you the proof you require. The following day would be the final event before Dr. Chua would finally call police. This time, Teresita would give Dr. Chua the name of her killer, and indeed, give him the proof he needed to give to the police, something the police weren't even aware of. Her killer was named Alan Showery. Alan had worked alongside Teresita and knew her very well. He worked in the respiratory unit as a technician. He lived close to Teresita's apartment complex. He visited her often in her home. Went to her concerts. She played for a classical band. His initials matched a note that the police had found in her living room, untouched by the fire. It read, Get tickets for AS. Up until police actually considered Alan, they hadn't really considered AS was for Alan Showery. The Chuas, mostly Dr. Chua, were still reluctant to come forward. It was tricky to imagine how to go about doing so while still being taken seriously. They decided to fib a little bit about how they came to the information, reporting to the police that Remy had received a threatening call from someone and believed it to be a fellow employee of the hospital. When asked who she thought it could have been, Remy would say, I believe it was Alan Showery. I'm terribly afraid of him. Upon following up on this lead, Detective Stahula, who had been investigating the Teresita's murder since the start, leading the investigation, sat interviewing the Chuas in their living room. He was there to follow up on this mystery call and just get more information about this Alan when he noticed the both of them looking kind of uncomfortable and nervous. Taking note of this, asking if the doctor was okay, if there was something he was wanting to say to him, it didn't take long before Dr. Chua stared over at his wife, both silently making a decision, turning back to the detective and saying, Tell me, Mr. Detective, do you believe in the occult or in exorcism? They would tell the detective everything. At that point, everything that had taken place, and they would also tell them the proof that they were going to need. Alan had taken jewelry from Teresita's bedroom that up until this point, not one officer was aware was missing. He had given some of it to his girlfriend. Dr. Chua went on. Teresita said the jewelry would be the evidence that you needed, and it would be. It would end up being the nail in the coffin for Alan Showery after Teresita's family was able to 100% identify it. Once Alan was in custody and fully aware that they had this proof and there was no getting out of this, and maybe thanks to a little bit of guilt for having murdered someone who trusted him, someone who called him her friend, he would confess to the murder and put every detail into a signed statement. He would only serve 14 years for the crime, which is not enough, but it's still something, I guess. Now, why did Alan murder his friend? What could it have been about? Why did he stab her with her own kitchen knife and set her place on fire? Money. He was behind on rent, and he thought she was loaded. Ended up walking away from the murder with a couple pieces of jewelry and $30. True crime, I tell you what. This is such an intense and very well-documented case. And as far as the phenomenon of ghosts helping to solve their own murder goes, it hits all the points. Teresita appeared, she spoke, she named names, gave proof. If you want to learn more about this fascinating case, Mr. Ballin did an excellent episode about it, but I would also recommend picking up a copy of the book written about it, Teresita, The Voice from the Grave. I'll link it below. Dudes, she also possessed a living person, which could open up a very interesting conversation about that particular phenomenon, ghost possession. It's rare that I hear stories about ghost possession, but I do come across them. So, listeners, please let me know if you want me to cover them before the season is over. Okay, now, this next one, you're going to immediately know this case. I'd bet dollars to donuts you are very familiar with this case. The coverage of it affected so many people, still does to this day. And while the strange paranormal aspects of it has been talked about a lot, actually, I'm not sure that I've heard any very deep look at it as a good example of justice dealt from the deceased. But I'd still like to present it here and see what you guys think and see if you guys don't agree with me that it most assuredly is. On August 13, 2018, in Frederick, Colorado, Christopher Lee Watts murdered his pregnant wife and two young daughters. He then buried his wife, Shanann, in a shallow grave and hid the bodies of his daughters, Bella and Celeste, inside of oil tanks. This was a devastating, heartbreaking story. Absolutely disgusting. Following the police arriving on site, Chris acted like his wife and daughters had gone missing. He didn't know nothing about nothing. But it only took 2 days before his charade came to an end, and he was arrested for the murders. Now, he was an idiot. This is true. He made a lot of mistakes, and his body language was pretty telling. Doesn't take a cop to tell you his mouth was saying one thing while his body was saying another. All captured on police cam. He did not get the death penalty, but did get multiple life sentences, so he is never getting out. The turnaround of this case from that first alarm raised by Shanann's friend to Chris's confession was super quick, but I think if it had gone beyond the 2 days that it did take, I think Shanann was prepared to raise hell. There is one police cam video in particular that I would like to call your attention to, and it was taken inside of the neighbor's house. The officer is standing in the living room, along with Nate, the neighbor, and Chris, who are both in frame. Nate is prepping the television to play back what he had captured on his security system the night before. Before playing this footage, there is a commercial that comes on the screen. I remember seeing this on the Netflix documentary and at the time sitting up like, what the actual hell is going on here? The commercial that plays is a promo for the upcoming season at the time for American Horror Story. Pretty on the nose, right? At one point, Chris looks over at it, and it actually causes him to mention for the first time that his wife is pregnant. The promo starts out with what looks like a baby in the womb. Turns out it's inside of an hourglass. Pans down to the bottom of the hourglass. Time runs out. A human skull then appears, submerged in oil. Small hands reach up from the oil to clasp the skull. And that is when Nate starts playing his footage, cutting off the commercial. But I think we saw everything we needed to see in this moment. This was the story, metaphorically and literally. We were shown before we knew. That cop was shown. The reason that I say Shanann was prepared to raise hell and get justice, if that is what happened, is not just because of this commercial, but that, in addition to all of the other strange stuff that took place, they captured on camera multiple EVPs. One that sounds like a woman's voice saying, "I'm with Cece," the nickname for Celeste. Another sounds like, "This is our home." There are numerous, but those popped out to me. There was also a strange noise that was audible to the officers who were there shortly following Chris's arrest. I believe that was the time frame. Sounds like a child's giggle. Now, some people think that that was definitely a toy, but even the officers who heard it, who were there, couldn't figure out what had made the sound. Possible figures were captured on camera. Not the little girl playing in the background that a lot of people were talking about at one point. That was the daughter of Shanann's friend, I believe. Maybe Nate's daughter. But other figures were captured. Faces in the windows. One night, someone even called in to report that they had seen a woman run into the house through the front door. Police went to check it out, cleared the home. There was no CCTV footage showing the woman ever leaving. The police didn't find anything but some lights that had been turned on. The footage of them walking through the quiet house was so eerie. I don't know, just indescribable. There was just a ton of potential activity in the following days, which makes the commercial all the more potent. The potential that all of this activity and the commercial playing at just that perfect moment, the potential that it was coordinated somehow by something unseen but present to draw attention, to drop hints that they were murdered, that Chris was their killer. I think that potential is there. It may have been all the combination of coincidence and audio pareidolia. I know what I think, but I will leave it to you guys to consider what you think of this example as a fit for the phenomenon of ghosts who help solve their own murders. I'd like to share one more story with you guys before we wrap the show today. This one is a completely different take on what we have already discussed. Just another way for us to consider the phenomenon. Many, many countries across the world hold a belief in reincarnation. It's often pointed out that stories that surface of children who remember their past lives and deaths are usually only found in predominantly reincarnation-friendly cultures. However, it can also be pointed out that perhaps that is the case because the parents of these freshly born people are open to it, and therefore keeping an eye out for things like birthmarks that may signify injury or death blows in a previous incarnation. And they also listen, really listen, to what the child is saying once it is able to speak. Unlike some Western societies who don't give it any thought at all and are definitely not open to further interpretation. There are numerous examples of children who have described their past lives down to the names of loved ones and details of their homes and hobbies that have been investigated by researchers such as Ian Stevenson and Eli Lash, and have been found to be quite accurate. Too accurate to be a coincidence. These children have also been able to detail exact means of their death and the people involved. There is one story in particular that can make us consider the topic of today's episode in a broader context. It may make us question if the ghost of the recently deceased is unable to bring themselves the justice they deserve for whatever reason. Is that simply the end of their story? If their spirit was unable, might they still have an opportunity for recourse in order to right the wrongs done to them? In the book Reincarnation, True Cases of Children Who Have Lived Before, written by Trutz Hardo, he relays a story told to him by Eli Lash. Dr. Lash had started out his medical career in the most conventional of ways before beginning to lean into other possibilities later in life, becoming a regression therapist and spiritual healer interested in reincarnation. During his time practicing in Israel, he had a firsthand experience in a group effort by the Druze people on the Golan Heights to follow up on the memories that were being reported by a 3-year-old boy in their community. Reincarnation made up a big part of the Druze belief system, and this tracking down and confirmation of past lives was a regular and special occasion. So, a board of inquiry, so to speak, was formed, led by respected elders in the village, and included the boy's father and representatives of the neighboring villages. Dr. Lash, because of his known interest in reincarnation, was also invited to participate. This boy had been born with a long red birthmark on his upper forehead. He had also already begun talking. What he had already been saying led the group to believe that in his previous incarnation, he had to have lived in one of the neighboring villages, hence the representatives of those villages being involved. And so the search began. They walked the boy to the first village. He said, nope. Second village, no dice. Upon visiting the third village, however, the boy perked up. This was where he had lived. And now that he was there, memories astirred. He suddenly remembered names of folks he had known. He also remembered his own, first and last. A local of the village recalled the name. Who the boy named had been a farmer who had suddenly gone missing 4 years prior. The villagers had just assumed the man had either been taken prisoner or killed by the Syrians. Nope. The boy says he had been killed by an axe blow to his head. As the group continued to walk, the boy pointed out the home in which he used to live. Then he suddenly pulled up in front of a man, asking him if he was so-and-so. Hardo writes in the book that Eli had just forgotten the name the boy gave, so we don't have that. But the man would answer, yes. The boy then said, I used to be your neighbor. We had a fight, and you killed me. According to Dr. Lash, the man suddenly went white as a sheet. The boy continued, I even know where he buried my body. The group, taking the neighbor along, okay, it's like, come here, come with me, followed the boy into a nearby field. He suddenly stopped in front of a pile of stones. He buried my body under these stones and the axe over there. The group began to dismantle the stones and discovered the skeleton of a grown man dressed in farmer's attire. The forehead of the skull was clearly split open. The boy then indicated where to dig for the axe. It didn't take them long before that was recovered as well. Following these discoveries, Dr. Lash would ask the people what would become of the murderer who had confessed, once the skeleton was uncovered, to what he had done. They replied, they would not be taking him to the police. Oh no. They would be deciding on an appropriate punishment themselves. Seems fair. That is where we will end our exploration for today. Thank you guys for catching this one. Send your thoughts on the matter to paranormgirlpod@gmail.com. Can a ghost get justice when the living drop the ball? Can a person risen in their post-ghost era? What was your favorite example? Did you hear a story today that you hadn't before? Let me know, peeps. Support the show by following on social @ParanormGirlPod. That is also my YouTube handle, YouTube, where you can find video versions of all of these episodes and catch me live once a month with the monthly guest series. I have been popping up live more frequently as of late these days. Not sure how that happened, but it is always good. It's always a fun time. Do not miss another one. Subscribe and then click the bell icon to be notified. You can actually look forward to the next live event coming up, though, next Thursday, 5 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Central. I am sitting down with Chris, one of the hosts of the Wandering Road podcast. Stellar show. Both hosts do a marvelous job of balancing their skeptical believership with humor throughout the topics that they cover and the guests that they welcome. Don't be caught unprepared, though, for this chat. Tune in to the Wandering Road podcast on all listening platforms, or just click the link that I've provided for your convenience in the notes. Get your questions together and get them answered next Thursday, May 15th, only on YouTube. We will see you there. Before I wrap it up, I owe shout-outs to some new patrons. I really owe them. I'm so behind. Jeremy became one of my researchers. You rock so hard, dude. Thank you. Thanks, man. And Dee joined my baby ghost tier. Thank you. Thank you, Dee. Very much appreciated. Welcome to the Patreon family, you guys. And you out there listening, if you would like to pitch in and help the show with things like obtaining new research materials, new recording equipment. Luckily, that does not happen all that often. I'm very careful with my stuff. 'Tis expensive, son. Or if you would like to contribute to PGP participation at upcoming events and paracons, Patreon is where you can support the show in these ways. It is also a two-way street, too. Patrons get early access to episodes like this, shout-outs on the show, and sometimes, I get a wild hair up my butt, and we do other things. I have shared Patreon-only content like blooper reels, backstage guest chats. Those are, I always share those on Patreon. But I also share announcements, sometimes months in advance, spooky stories not included on the regular show, stuff like that. Recently, we did a movie night, Legend of Boggy Creek. If you are interested, but unsure where to start, you can sign up for free for a trial period. Check it out at patreon.com/ParanormGirlPod. That is all for today. Thank you guys once again. I will see some of you at the live on the 15th, and I'll catch the rest of you back here in 2 weeks for our next deep dive drop. Until then, stay safe, keep the nightlight on, and sleep with one eye open.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.